eminent scholar lecturer of the Institute for Advanced Studies. My name is John Junkins. It's a great honor to welcome our speaker today. He's a member of our TIAS fellow cadre, and just a brief word. We have just appointed our fifth class of 10 fellows who will be inducted officially in February at the annual gala. And this brings to 45 the number of scholars that we brought to campus. And for those of you who haven't been tracking the Institute for Advanced Studies, I want to share with you a comment from one of our distinguished former students who apparently has a gift for exaggeration. He said that the creation and operation of the Institute for Advanced Study is the greatest thing to happen at Texas A&M since the discovery of women in 1962. I think this might be a minor exaggeration, but as our current vice president would say, it is a really, really big deal, which is changing the game at Texas A&M. It really is driven by the ambitions of this university and the ambitions of the faculty to bring in really accomplished peoples and areas of emphasis to provide the fertilization of the faculty and the students. And this is certainly a prime example you're about to enjoy this evening. Richard Gibbs directs one of the five centers that completed the Human Genome Project. And it is presently one of the three genome centers funded by NIH. He's at the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. He's won numerous honors. And one of the things that, in layman's term, which I certainly am in his field, that we can characterize his work by, the mapping of the genome is one thing. Finding a way to translate that knowledge into therapies is another. And as I think I've noted from some of his work, we had a lot of early success with childhood therapies. But us adults are more complicated animals. We have to confuse our genome by all the environmental and other stress factors that we have, and trying to make progress on this front is an area that he's had particular interest in. Richard Gibbs holds the Wolford Cain Chair and is a distinguished professor in molecular and human genetics at the Baylor College of Medicine. Their current research is focused on the genomics of cancer, heart disease, and autism. And this is a part of a national program in systematic discovery of the cause of human single gene defects, and has an active program in bioinformatics with research projects involving biologists and computer scientists. So this field, he certainly shares something in common with me as a rocket scientist. We both are very broad in the narrow sense. Gibbs received the Michael E. DeBakey Excellence in Research Award in 2000 and the Chancellor's Distinguished Lectureship at Louisiana State University in 2001. He's been elected to the National Academy of Medicine, formerly the Institute of Medicine, and also the Texas Academy of Medicine Science, Medicine Engineering and Science. He's a native of Australia, got his doctorate at the University of Melbourne, and you might detect that we have an accent, he doesn't, as he speaks. Please welcome Richard Gibbs.
Thank you, John. Well, thank you very much, John. And actually, let me begin by formally thanking you and the TIAS and Clifford for having me here as part of your program, and David Houston for introducing me to the program. Thank you for saving me. I mean, after 30 years in science, someone asked me what I did the other day, and all I could think to say was I do emails and I write grants and I deal with personnel problems. And of course, and I also explained to someone today what the PETA principle was, Those of you who don't know, most of you probably do. This is where you're promoted to your level of incompetence. I used to be pretty good in the laboratory. Got promoted continually. Now I guess I'm not so good because I don't get promoted anymore. So it's been a real pleasure to, through your support, to be able to start to think creatively again about science and expand, expand, regress, get back into what was really important. I should introduce myself to those of you I haven't met. I see a few old friends in the audience. I am the director of the Genome Center at Baylor. We've been now in business for 20 years. That's a lot of emails and a lot of grants, I can tell you. And we are, our activity revolves around genomics and advancing genomic technologies. Right now we're producing about 2,000 human genomes a month, which is a big number. And we apply that knowledge into problems in human genetics, cancer, and other areas of biology and practical issues. You see, this pie chart shows you that almost all of that sequencing is about genetics of different kinds. So, and today I'd like to point out where we are in this journey towards precision medicine. Many of you, I'm sure, saw President Obama's announcement of the Precision Medicine Program. It's really the idea that what is given to you in your personal medical treatment is tailored to you through intimate knowledge of your biology. It was good to hear that it's a national program. It was a surprise to hear it was renamed. It was personalized medicine shortly before that. And for those of us in the genome era, it was really just an extension of the notion or the paradigm that we subscribed to when we began the Human Genome Project, with the idea of digitizing biology and bringing some science to many of the things that were done empirically. So the genome ethos really was sequence the genome, that is, describe all the parts and blueprints of the cell so that you can use that for a platform to understand all processes, and then you can manipulate the biological system that you're working with. Now, we didn't want to just do that with Swiss watches, of course. We all the time wanted to do that with humans and with disease, and to set up this paradigm where you as a patient would come in with your family history, perhaps with some known genetic condition, but everything else about you that was presented to your physician along with your genomic sequence, a lot of analysis, and somehow that would all sum together and you'd get the magic pill that was just right for you and not right for anybody else. That's the model. Now, we all know how hard this is, and I thought, well, what's a good way to illustrate how hard it is? Do you remember when the cystic fibrosis gene was cloned, the most common of the severe childhood diseases? Way back in 1989, there's Francis and Lapchi and a colleague in Toronto celebrating. It took about 25 years, I think, before the first few drugs were derived from that discovery. And even now, the drugs that you can get, this is a successful treatment of a cystic fibrosis child who's now a grown-up young man. He's a success story for a drug, but he has one of the rare mutations for this disease. He doesn't have the common mutation for this disease. Those drugs are still just now coming online. So that's how long it takes for a problem that's ostensibly simple, that's this model of describe, understand, then you can manipulate. The bottom line here being, it's really just not that simple. So really, I think to embody and to embrace this whole notion of precision medicine, we've got to acknowledge that this can't be done. We can't just turn on a faucet and have this happen for us. We can't just change our ideas about the way we do things. We really need to properly integrate the practice of medicine with the research that has to happen in clinical scenarios and with an understanding of the biology of human disease to bring this basic fundamental digital knowledge to play to get everything to work together. So what I want to talk to you about really is how we're doing with that and how we are actually getting there. And I think, you know, whenever people ask, when are these developments going to happen? The answer is always in 5 years. Well, I think we're within 5 years of things really getting to a magic moment of completion, a real 5 years. Now, to set this up, I'll give you a very, like a one-slide history of genetics and the status of genetics that is actually shown in this nice diagram, but not to focus on that. Here, please, and over here. On the left-hand side, I've depicted the simple problems in human genetics. Human inherited single gene diseases, these are the pediatric diseases. They're like cystic fibrosis and all of those other cases where the single gene, if it's broken or altered in some way, can be connected to a single disease phenotype with high penetrance. You've got the mutation, you've got the disease. If you've got the disease, you know you've got the mutation. That's Mendelian disease over here. And over on the other side, we have the phenomenon of adult disease. And as John was alluding, that this is what, you know, this is the grail here. How do we solve these problems? This is heart disease, schizophrenia, cancer, congestive failure, liver failure, all the things that get you when you're old, and which are polygenic, which that is, they have many different gene mutations somehow contribute to their architecture. Now, our journey to understand the digital version of biology and to put that in the context of how we explain human disease is synonymous with the idea of understanding the genetic architecture of human inherited disease. If we can understand the rules behind all the ways that both single genes can impact our ultimate disease state and some combination of genes could influence our disease state as adults, then we'd say we've understood the genetic architecture of human disease. Now, not to spoil the story, but this is working great. This is really a challenge, but we're making good progress. And because this hasn't fallen into place very simply, that is, the stories of these adult gene architectures isn't that straightforward, this area has become of great interest, the idea of oligogenics, where there are just a few genes that somehow can contribute in a way to explaining adult disease states. Not many genes, each with weak effect, but just a few genes with strong effect. So as the models have contrasted the study of single genes and have contrasted the study of adult diseases and have focused more on this oligogenic state, we now finally see real data emerging to support it. So I'm going to just walk you through a bit of this and some of this and tell you about this, and then we'll be much more confident about where we are with this understanding of human genetic architecture and the keys to understanding how we can deliver precision medicine. Now, our success in the first area has been driven by the spectacular advances in technology that I'll only have one slide or so to show you about, and that is the idea that we can sequence whole human genomes, at least crudely, not perfect end-to-end genomes, for a couple of $1,000s. And even more spectacularly, we have methods based upon oligonucleotide synthesis that can be used to extract the genic portions of genomic DNA ahead of the experiment. So you only have to sequence the genes that are 1% of the genome. You don't have to do the whole thing. You can save a lot of money, you can do things more quickly, and you can interpret the part that you most understand. And those methods were developed in the beginning around 2007, was our first experiment, and we've refined them over the years. There's a lot of debate out there, which one is better, should you do a whole genome or just sequence the genes? But unless you're really interested in doing one sample in tremendous detail, or you want to focus on the non-genic proportions, if you want to make maximum discovery and get the best value for your money, these abbreviated methods are really terrific. Parenthetically, I will tell you that the vendor who makes these wonderful instruments that we're using for whole genomes has licensed us not to use them for this abbreviated method. So it still costs $500 or $600 at the base cost to do a sequence for any one of you. But if we had our freedom to operate, we could probably do it for less than $100. Imagine that, a complete gene readout for less than $100. Now, so we've ridden this wave and enjoyed applying this technology to this journey from doing the first few genomes to getting in the clinic, and I've mapped this out for you here to explain how that's happened. You know, we did the Human Genome Project finishing just around the turn of the century, and that was our reference sequence. And then we did a series of individual genomes as the technologies improved. In Houston, we gave James Watson his first diploid genome on a hard drive in a big ceremony and learned as we did that that he was the first next-generation genome and how much individual variation we each have. There are literally hundreds of genetic differences between each of us. We didn't know that before the Watson Project. We did an African genome, which showed about the vast amount of additional variation in those populations. And then we got into medical biology by doing a whole genome sequence of my colleague James Lupsky, who has Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease, and he'd been looking for the cause of his own gene defect for 15 years, 20 years, and for $50,000 we found it in one sequencing experiment. It was quite remarkable. Then we went on to sequence some twins with a movement disorder, and they remain our poster childs for this kind of activity because after we sequenced them, we figured out they didn't have exactly the genetic lesion that people assumed. They had a slightly different one. Now they take a single supplementary pill and their movement disorder is completely ameliorated. And they're, like I say, they're our poster childs. They're in college running varsity sports and things like that. So after this period of development since the turn of the century, we developed those capture methods to pull out the genes, did some additional discovery here and pushed things into a diagnostic laboratory. Now, I'll tell you about this in a bit more detail because that's some of the exciting stuff. About 5-6 years ago, because of these technical developments, the NIH started a program to have us catalogue and discover all of those simple gene problems, all of the Mendelian disorder problems. Now, remember, there's about 20,000 human genes. There are probably 10,000 or slightly less for which there is a case where there's a single gene defect in a child and there's a phenotype, a disease phenotype associated. So we wanted to build a catalogue with all 10,000 genes mapped to all 10,000 phenotypes. It's a bit more complicated than that, but that's basically what we're headed for. So we're up to about 3,000 5 years ago. This program started and joined together ourselves and other a few other NIH-supported groups and began that discovery process. Now, part of that discovery meant getting samples in order to find ideal situations where we had disease discovery possibility. In general, at that time, this meant a clinical investigator had been studying a family and seen a phenotype segregate in the family. That meant if we went in and sequenced the family, we'd have a good chance of finding a gene that looked different in the affected than in the unaffected members of the family. And if we had enough families like that, we could assign the gene to the phenotype and make the cause. Very successful. 150 genes or so discovered after a few years and sequencing 6,000 or 7,000 samples. But it used a lot of communication, a lot of people driving around trying to find cases that could be sequenced. Successful, I say, because we published a lot of papers and found, by the end of the program, 200 new genes, depending on your criteria for a new gene. Now, part of the burden of this was not just getting the samples, but once you had this couple of families that appeared to have a gene which was causative of the phenotype, in order to be absolutely sure, unless you could get a lot of families and have huge statistics, you had to go in and do functional studies on the gene to prove that that was the one that you really should be concerned about. So in this period of the study, an ideal project would be one or two families, a segregating phenotype in the human, you find a gene that's altered in all the affected individuals in the families, not in the unaffected individuals, then you go to the mouse and you alter the same gene and you find the same phenotype, a very similar phenotype, and you say, aha, we've got proof now that this is the gene that is important for that phenotype, and we add it into the Mendelian catalogue. Now, that's a great way to do the science, but unfortunately, it's slow, and when we have several thousand more genes to get, it is really impractical to do that at the scale we need to do it. So whilst we were wondering how we could expand the collection material here and how we could do faster functional studies, in recognition of the fact that we needed a lot of samples, we started to look at our clinical situation and realised that could be a source of more material. So around that time, this is 2011, I'm sorry for all the acronyms here, but what happened is the guys on the left, that's the Genome Centre with all the technology, got together with the guys on the right, the clinical geneticists who were seeing patients and knew how to do things with insurance payments and all that kind of stuff, and we built a laboratory that was for applying these techniques for any child that had even a suspicion of a genetic disease. And that, here's my disclosure, the Baylor College of Medicine, my employer, actually sold this whole enterprise into a partnership 3 years ago, and we get access to the data, but it's now a commercial enterprise. I don't have any personal interest, but the school does. But this was tremendously successful, this clinical activity, and it grew from a few in the first month to what is now a few hundred a month, even beyond this graph, limited right now only by the insurance payment rate. The people often get declined for their insurance. That's a whole other discussion. But over the thousands of samples that accrued through this method, we established a reliable 25 to 30% diagnostic rate. That is, children would come to the clinic, they'd get referred in for the diagnostic test, we'd sequence their genes with the new technology, and then look up the Mendelian catalogue, the catalogue of genes, and any time they had a mutation in a gene that was already in the catalogue, we'd say this was a closed clinical case. We've shown what the clinical diagnosis is. Now, that left 75% of the cases that were unsolved. I'll come back to those in one moment. But the cases that were solved and the understanding of those it in itself added to our understanding of genetics. Some of the medical faculty here went and did a detailed analysis of the first 6,000 and showed, among other things, that apart from the occasional, the 25% that had the disease-causing mutation in it, there were many findings of unknown significance that were yet to be explained. There were often these kind of findings, which include notion of a carrier status in the family, a marker which might reflect pharmacogenomics or reaction to drugs, and another unrelated, unexpected finding that could be of interest to the person, like a sudden heart death gene or something like that. So we developed the whole science of reporting here based around that. Now, the 75% that were unsolved, we now established a pipeline to transfer those over to research so we could then go and discover the genes that were in that pool. Okay. Here's another genetic finding that was a surprise to us. At the outset, we had little idea of what the contribution of de novo mutation, that is, new mutations, would be to both the autosomal dominant and the recessive cases in these situations. Previously, it was really family history that gave you the guide that you were likely to have an individual come in and have a genetic ascertainment for a gene which was known to be in a genetic disease. But with the expanded sequencing ability and more people coming in, we more and more began to see de novo mutations in the children as being the cause of the problem. The new findings that we discovered that was kind of shocking to us was the number of cases for which there were actually two Mendelian diseases in the same individual. So this is a case where a child comes into the clinic, there is an inability to diagnose the child just by clinical features because the phenotype's unusual. You look at the molecular data, you find a disease gene, and then you keep looking, you find a second disease gene. It's like the child has two Mendelian diseases going on at the same time. And the number of these was nearly 6% of all cases, and a few of those actually had three, and a couple even had four Mendelian diseases going on at the same time. So this is striking in the sense of what drives complexity. Now, this discovery pipeline is important and growing the catalogue is important, and that's shown here by the fact that many of the diagnoses we made at any moment are in genes that were only identified in the last couple of years. So the Mendelian catalogue is growing. The number of genes we know, if there's a mutation that it's a disease gene, then as that grows, then it's more likely that a new case coming in will be in a gene that was recently discovered. So all of that, what I've told in the last five slides, happens over on the clinical side, and I allude to the fact we push these over to the research side. That's actually quite a bit of work because over here we have all the HIPAA rules and patient privacy. Over here we have research subjects, and in the middle we have this big wall. So we spend a lot of time figuring out how to get samples over here with the least amount of effort. But we've managed to do that by a long series of solving small problems. And that's the result then, is that the clinical sample collection is now the major driver of the sample accrual for the research discovery. And that earlier slide I showed you with the flags, people driving around the world and going to every country to get samples to put into the hopper, we're not doing so much of that anymore. It's simply a case of the individuals who've got the interesting genetics are just lining up at the door at the clinic for their regular clinical service, and the ones that aren't solved instantly clinically, we now research. We consent them and bring them over to the research side. And here's a graph showing a number of cases in the last year or so that have been solved in this way. And the WGL to CMG, the green part, samples from the clinical side, and here they've been joined to samples from other individuals that have come in either from the CMG, the blue, which is our Mendelian discovery program, the one that originally had people driving around the world, and another thing here called Gene Matcher. And Gene Matcher is a computer program where if you think you have a gene that's involved in a disease, you simply load it into that network, and it searches everybody else's databases, and if it finds somebody else who's interested in that gene, then it will email the two of you and connect you as collaborators so you can go ahead and work on that gene. But this kind of mixing of all samples all around the world is working pretty well. Here's an example that's very near and dear to me. This is actually my grandniece. And my niece turned up with her second child having severe problems. And I, of course, being the geneticist in the family, said, we've got to sequence the family. And I was told, there's no family history, et cetera, et cetera. And so they actually went on that diagnostic odyssey. But we did indeed sequence them and found a mutation in a gene, AT-hook DNA binding motif containing protein number 1. Nobody had ever heard of it. There's almost no publications about it. And then we looked in our own databases. We found these other three children also with the same new mutation in that gene and with similar phenotypes. So we're able to aggregate them and call them a new syndrome. And we're, one of the reasons I belabor this particular gene as a product of our research program is that the TS support is helping us to delve further into that. So we started by encouraging the families who came forward with this to get together, and they have a Facebook page now, and there's 25 to 30 families that talk together through social media. We estimate, based on various guesstimates, that worldwide there are probably 1 to 5,000 children with this disorder. We'd like to find them all. We've started a proper registry just now where the families are actually coming in and putting their clinical data into a secure environment so we can start to mine the clinical data. And we've indeed started looking at the protein details here. This is the gene up top. Some very concerted and thoughtful protein searches with our collaborators have revealed two gene relatives. You can see here this is homology shared across evolutionary space. You're familiar with these kind of plots, I'm sure. Shows amino acid conservation. There are two other genes that share motifs with our first gene, the AHDC1. And two of those are actually disease genes with other phenotypes. So we're now building our network of understanding around these three relatives. So that this particular example then shows you one gene challenge, and it's a model for how to integrate functional analysis into gene discovery, since we're going ahead now, based upon the knowledge of the gene structure and the mutation position, to build some mouse models here with David Threadgill's group and student Anna Salvador, who's in the audience, and we will use those to explore the mechanism of action of this gene. All great to do, but actually a little slow. So that's the left-hand side of that first chart I showed you with Mendel on the left and adult disease on the right, and I've told you that this is actually going extremely well. We're up to about 5,000 worldwide of the 10,000 genes. I think we had 5,000 of them. We have diseases where we can connect phenotype to gene. And we've revealed lots of complexity of those kind of stories with multiple genes going on in the same individuals. And this is not really, though, yet getting us to this issue of adult disease. This is my sort of interlude slide. And I actually use this for a genome. People always want to close down the genome centres. Right? From the beginning, they wanted to close them down, not bother doing the genome project. We finished the genome, shut down the genome centres. We did the HapMap project, shut down. So now we've done this. The message is, so I rounded up the genome centre. I said, this is you guys. I said, you've built the rockets, and you've got the rocket fuel working and all the problems here. And there's our genetics colleagues running around saying how great it is to be on the moon. Right? This is where I understand the shuttle did not go to the moon. But most of my biology colleagues are not concerned about that. I said, so I told the center, I said, okay, you've got a choice now. Do you want to be this guy, which is the spent fuel lying on the ground, or let's go to Mars? Okay, and that's a real picture of Mars, I believe. Mars is adult clinical genetics. Mars is this other side of the chart. Let's solve that.
Okay.
So now I'm backtracking you a bit here. This is our diagram of how we got to solving Mendelian disease. Through the various genome projects and getting into the diagnostic lab. But over here, I've put the a timeline, and I've put the technologies rather than the social impact. So here we had whole genomes by early whole genome methods, and we got into those gene extraction methods for the latest here. Now, the question I'll put is, what do we need then to go to Mars to do the adult side of the problem? Well, we need to solve all of these issues. So we need to understand how we can mine large discovery cohorts in order to find the adult disease genes. And for that, we're going to need thousands of whole genomes from adults. And that's actually going on right now, and I've kind of given a funny timescale here. This is the beginning and end of what I think that period will be. Over the next couple of years, we're likely to generate a couple of million genomes over all programs. For that, we need that information to fully solve this question of the architecture of genetic disease to make our models, and I think that will happen contemporaneously with a good start now. We need these large-scale functional testing methods in simple automated assays to augment that discovery, and that's going to happen over this period. And we need big data operations in order to understand how to manipulate all of this and mine it in a way that actually has a lot of nuance about it. We need scale, but we also need data methods that can transport across different data structures, which is not a trivial issue. And that's beginning now, but that's going to take us several years. And we need to push this into the medical record so we can properly integrate there with an automated compliant environment. If we learnt nothing from our single gene studies, it is that once you get into the clinic, everything gets easier because you have the sample access. Therefore, if we're ever going to get the adult studies to work out, we have to get that going there as well. So I'm just going to tell you, for the remainder of the talk, a bit about these points, how we're doing here, and a bit about this. So I could spend a lot of time talking about mining the cohorts. This is just one example, and it's such a beautiful one. It illustrates how we're really making progress here. One of our sample collections is the ARAC study. It's the Atherosclerotic Risk in the Community study, and it's a longitudinal study of adults chosen, not because they had any particular problem, but because they were in a particular geographical place. They signed up for the program, they got clinical workup, and that's been continuing for years. And now that we've been able to sequence into those cohorts, we've got individuals who are going back and mining the sequence data and looking at the clinical phenotypes and all the accrued information, looking for genetic associations. And Linda Poffers here went in and looked at some of the hematopoietic system and ended up looking at platelet production because it was a phenotype that really came out strongly. What she found is that there was a particular gene marker. This is a one-letter change. It's a SNP. It's in this gene, GFI1B, and it correlates with a reduction in platelet count. And that was replicated in another population, so it was a robust statistical discovery. And then there were two more developments. The first one was the acknowledgement that this gene has been seen before. Severe mutations in this gene actually cause a disease called Gray syndrome, which has severe platelet ablation. That's a good sign. The second thing is when our collaborators in the St. Karen lab went ahead and engineered this change into a cell line, and they looked at its effect on DNA on expression, and when they used another model system where they looked at actual platelet production, the predictions from the association were borne out. So through a genetic mining of these large cohorts, we'd found a signal and gone back and replicated that in a functional study. We now got a gene for reducing platelet levels, which is a significance because low platelet levels are a risk factor in certain disorders. Okay, so that's a very, very quick summary of everything about common disease. I could go on with other studies about partial findings of common disease associations, but the bottom line here is that at least some of these gene associations are quite discoverable. I've used the word endophenotypes here. Actually, this is a real disease phenotype. I think you could say the one I just showed you. And that these have a lot of utility. Now, this is not really solving adult disease, and it's not getting us into that point that I wanted to bring up about oligogenics, which is in between the large, the common disease studies and the Mendelian studies. So let me say a word now about oligogenics. In the background of all that other work, we've developed strategies to look for true oligogenic data models. The general approach has been to pick on a syndrome for which there is some good, strong genetic data known. There are some cases where there is clear single gene inheritance, but there are many sporadic cases that belong in the syndrome but are not easy to explain genetically. So we take those and then we sequence the individuals who haven't been explained yet, and we look for genes that may be the contributing factor and ones that are in a larger group of genes associated with the contributing factor. And then take all those possible disease alleles and try and fit formal genetic models. Now, ideally, we'd fit quantitative models because we have a lot of samples and we'd be able to simply come out and give us good, robust statistical answers in many cases. Mostly, though, we try and fit qualitative models where a bit of statistics below significance plus some functional studies give us an idea of interaction between individual disease gene-associated genetic markers to build the genetic model. Now, the short story here is that over the last several years, we've done this in many different syndromes, and for most of them, actually, it's been a bust if the criteria for success is that you find a true oligogenic model. That is, you find multiple genes that have got on their own important alleles that are interacting in a way that is statistically important and is functionally validated. We've tried this in cerebral palsy. We found many actual genetic causes of what was supposedly cerebral palsy, but no interactive loci. We did it in Parkinson's disease. We found new genes, but again, no interaction. We did it in a series of neurological diseases and in arthrogryposis. Same story then, there's some suggestion of an interaction here. But despite that, we have one syndrome where we actually have found what is now a poster child for oligogenics. So this is Charcot-Marie-Tooth, and it's the disorder that I referred to earlier that my colleague James Lupsky has, and we found the familial form in him. He has three affected siblings and four unaffected. It was a clear case of a recessive form of the disease. Charcot-Marie-Tooth, I think 25 years ago or 30 years ago, used to be thought of as one thing. It was a movement disorder. And then there was the discovery of the major gene that causes about 60 or 70% of it. It was recognised that that was one form, and then there were other forms. And then as more and more genes became discovered, it was realised there were more and more molecular forms. There's about 60 genes now, any one of which can cause Charcot-Marie-Tooth. And yet the familial forms and the explained forms are only a small percentage of all Charcot-Marie-Tooth patients. We don't have the general model for everybody. But we did this exact experiment. We took sporadic cases and sequenced them, and then we found this. We found that if we, in the histogram here, if we did a statistical analysis and looked at carefully matched control individuals, and we compared those with patients with the disease, and we compared them by the criteria of how many potentially damaging alleles they had amongst all genes that were ever involved in neuropathies. Now, there's about 20,000 genes, as I said. There are about 400 that are in that neuropathy gene space. If you just look at that 400 and you compare the burden in these cases versus controls, you see an excess. So this is the statistical basis of a genetic burden model. I could talk after, if you like, about any of the caveats here. But this is exciting to us because none of those other studies had given us this oligogenic signal. Now, in addition to the statistical data, we collaborated with Nico Katsanis, a zebrafish geneticist that we know well, and he made some models in zebrafish. And what he did is he took all the alleles, so the cases where you had an individual with multiple alleles in different genes, he made those both alleles in the fish, and went to see if he got a more severe phenotype than if he just put one of the alleles in on their own. And he indeed found these additive effects by looking at the morphology of the zebrafish with these different allelic combinations. In other words, he's got functional information that backed up the statistical model of interaction between individual genes with alleles of high penetrance. So that backs up the oligogenic model and gives us an idea that genetic burden can indeed give rise to some of these complicated phenotypes. So far what I've done is I've taken you through these complicated genetic stories, right? I told you about the Mendelian cases that we're solving very quickly and very easily now with advanced sequencing, augmented by the clinical supply. We're doing pretty well, but only with a few instances in these large cohorts with adults. We're beginning to understand some genes that can contribute to phenotypes. And we're particularly excited now because in these syndromic conditions, with enough data, we can see that we can build oligogenic models that really are kind of beginning to be robust, generalizable understandings of human genetic architecture. Now, the problem we got is we don't have enough of these syndromic cases to really build genome-wide, utterly undeniably significant, statistically significant models. We simply need more cases. And again, what we've learned from the Mendelian studies is if we want to build those kind of numbers, we need to get these technologies into the clinic and make them routine collections. So the EHR integration and working with big data are really the obstacles. Now, the EHR integration, we're tackling that programmatically. We're working with... this is one of those things where there's a lot of little problems to solve. And so in these large networks, we're all getting together. This is one called the eMERGE, the electronic medical record and genome data that's supported by the NIH that we're part of. where multiple different sites collect samples, send them to us as a sequencing center, and then those samples come in the door, we process them and send them back their clinical reports, and we spend all of our time thinking about what are the structured data that will go back into the medical record that we can then recover again and put into research sharing capabilities. This is going on. It's not very glamorous, but it's happening right now, and I think another year or two we'll be in a good state there. Now, the only remaining issue then is big data, and that's another buzzword like precision medicine. So we need big data pipes and methods to work with the big data. I'm pretty optimistic there. This is my favourite slide to show off to you all. I get a lot of people coming to us and telling us about big data solutions and big data problems and telling us to expect big data all around the Texas Medical Center. And finally, one of my guys in the IT department came up with this and said, I don't know, do you think this is interesting? So I'll tell you what it is. It's the entire egress in and out of the medical center over these key few weeks, randomly chosen over the last couple of months. The genome center is the blue, and the little bit of color is every other medical center institution and Baylor. Here's MD Anderson. Here's the Methodist Hospital, that bit of green. The five things here, that tends to be the work week. People come in and download their email, right? And then the other stuff. So anyway, the point is we've got a lot of data flowing, and we shouldn't have much trouble actually bussing it around. Now, working it with it's another thing. And what we've been able to do here is build a data lake, and I'm sure some of you have gone through the journey I have. You've now learned about Hadoop and Parquet file structures and security certificates and SOAP calls and APIs and all that stuff. It's really horrible. So the data lake we've built now contains 50,000 genome variant sets, and we're able just now to turn it on and start to do analytics with it. So we take our clinical data and push it in there. And so that's the secure data lake, and this is really just the projects and the sources of data. And here's just two quick experiments. These are hot off the presses. The first query we did, now this is working with a variant data, but not the phenotype data. So we just take these genotypes from all these individuals, but we know them from a clinical source. And then we apply a set of criteria. We want to find a gene that's not already in the gene catalogue. We want to know there's a damaging mutation in it, that it's rare, not that mutation has never been put anywhere, and that the gene is not known to be frequently mutated by looking up certain databases. And then straight away we find 50 candidates or so, and actual disease genes, because we go to the literature and some of them are just now being published. They haven't been put in the disease gene rack. That's a stunning thing to take just a bunch of clinical data and extract with a simple query. And the second one we did right after that, looking at missense mutations, not loss of function, we've got 100 genes. This time, when we were a bit smarter, we did the experiment. We, same as above, except no omum genes. In other words, we took all genes. We didn't ask if the gene had already been identified as a gene catalog in the gene catalog. Omum means the Mendelian inheritance in man. This means it's already a disease gene. So second query, we said missense genes, all these other criteria. Let's see what we've got. We've got 100 hits. 33 of them are known disease genes, and 66 others then are likely. So the bottom line for this, I'm sorry, these are the least slick slides. The bottom line for these is we now have a method with all of this data at once in different odd structures to do trivial queries in very short time and pull out with high confidence disease gene candidates. So that's, despite it took us like about $1 million and a year to build this data infrastructure, it's really doing a good job and allowing us to do some good mining. So that's a lot of stuff. How do we bring this all together? Well, I can tell you that, that the simple pediatric cases with clinical integration, this enterprise is going really well, and our Mendelian catalogue is really coming along quite strongly. And we're doing okay with the complex adult genetic cases, which we're now getting clinical integration through these other mechanisms. That's evolving. If we get larger numbers, we think more discovery through the understanding of these oligogenic models will come to us, and that'll be the real key to guiding these precision medicine approaches. And I think then that's, as I said at the beginning, this is what puts us within 5 years of having this kind of situation where you can derive real meaning from these kind of data in your clinical interface. So that's the end of my comments. I thank you all for listening. This, of course, doesn't happen in any kind of vacuum. I have a large team with many individuals you'll recognise, particularly Donna Musney, who's worked with me for 30 years, who is an A&M graduate, and Eric Bowinkle, who's now the Dean of Public Health for the UT system and is the Associate Director. And again, thanks to John, Clifford and David and to the TIAS. Thank you very much.
I believe Dr. Gibbs would entertain some questions. Do we have any?
How often, when you find your faces, can you do something about it?
Very rarely, of course, now. Probably 1% to 5% in the Mendelian cases. As I mentioned, our poster child for the Mendelian studies is still our poster child after, you know, 5 or 6 years. But the degree of energy that's been put now to therapeutics in these simple cases is really refreshing. I think there's a realization that those, if successful, can then be transferred and relevant for adult therapeutics. So I think there's a level of optimism coming from just drug-based therapeutics in that space.
Other questions? We have one here.
So, Richard, of the oligogenic disorders, do those follow Mendelian inheritance patterns, or what percentage of those are actually spontaneous, multiple spontaneous within an index case?
It's a case of practically everything you can imagine is seen in the numbers that we have. So we see de novo occurrences in multiple genes in the same individual with a de novo at one site and an inherited mutation at another. One nuance in the data I showed you from the Charcot-Marie tooth is that there are a few cases there where the burden explains the entire phenotype, but no single gene story would be a Mendelianizable form. But in the majority of them, there is one locus for where you would expect that to be a CMT cause, but a mild cause. But the phenotype is much more severe than what you expect. And the other genes are adding the burden that is giving the worse of phenotype. Is that? I think that's a great question, and what's the next frontier? So the focus is almost entirely on disease, apart from the few wellness studies. But I think the real excitement is in things like subclinical cognitive space. I mean, that's odd behaviours or particular, you know, modes of cognition. So the answer is yes, but unfortunately so, and I think the quicker we can broaden that net. I mean, I want to tell you the AHDC1 story, we think that mild mutations in that locus may cause a hypertonia. We have a quick screen for the locus, and we want to go out in the kind of clinics where the children are not, the kind of community care places where the children are a bit hypertonic, but they're not spending much time in the clinic, and see if we can pick up the gene there. So I'd love to see genetic screens in every dentist and every ophthalmologist. Yeah, so there's a bias towards loss of function with a little understanding amongst this huge number of autosomal dominant de novos, whether or not they're haploinsufficient or there's some dominant negative effect. So we don't know how much of that is ascertainment or not, I think. Now, the question about which do you extrapolate into an adult disorder, probably the loss of functions are playing a less direct role into the adult cases, because we would have found them by the methods we've got now. Does that make sense? Yeah, and you know, of course, the dream is you find the loss of function in the Mendelian case, and you go in the adults, and you find the subtle mutations in the adult. But we're just, since the breast cancer gene, that just hasn't worked out that easily.
Necessarily order them, nor have you sequence the other stuff in the genome.
Yes. So there are three levels of sequencing, I'd say, which get used interchangeably. When we sequence the exome, as I referred to in many of these studies, it's just the genes by this method of quickly extracting them. Although we know a lot about where they are in their order, we are ignoring everything else. When we say we sequence the whole genome, it generally means that we have a 30 times coverage of the newest technology across the whole genome. But that gives us most things, but it doesn't give us some of the very complicated regions that we need to use yet additional methods to solve. So I think that's happy to elaborate, but that's the broad answer. Well, no doubt that epigenetic modifications and variation of those modifications is a disease driver. But the question is, how do we find those best? And most likely, we will find those by looking at conditions where we believe a particular gene should have a mutation, but it just doesn't have a mutation. So we think, you know, we've got 100 cases where we know this gene is mutated. We've got the 101st case. We don't find that. So then we look around the gene, we may find a non-coding DNA change, or we may find an epigenetic change. And this, we believe, will be the gateway into understanding more about the epigenetic mechanisms of pathogenesis. But just to blindly screen looking for epigenetic solutions, I think, is not doable yet. I'm sorry, I didn't get all the questions. For meta-analysis of standard...
of genome-wide association studies?
Yeah. Like many things, once you look under the hood, you know, you're horrified at what you find. And so when we blithely say it's great, we'll have a million genomes or 2 million genomes in 5 years, then we would perhaps assume you could compare them and compare the phenotypes in a nice way. Well, it turns out that the phenotype comparisons are the hardest thing of all, and there's very little standardization there, and that much of the day-to-day work of people in this area is to standardize the collected phenotypes from two sets of data and in order to compare them to make associations. I'm thinking this sounds familiar to you, right? Well, the DNA part is actually pretty easy. It's, you know, despite small differences in the collecting of the DNA part of the data, you can generally standardize there and compare them. But comparing the phenotypes is going to take more work with ontologies and with the dedication to that task that really hasn't fully been realized. So the modifiers that reduce the expressivity have not been found, but there are certainly reports of individuals with Mendelian alleles that damn well should give them a severe Mendelian disease, but they are ostensibly healthy. Some of those reports are controversial, but I think this is exactly the gateway. And back to the question about looking at non-disease individuals, looking at these modifiers is going to be extremely interesting. So it's an underexplored field.
Let me ask a final question in the form of a comment and a question on behalf of all of the students in the audience, including me, you know, especially those students that are looking through career paths. One thing that strikes me about your work is deep knowledge of genetics that you have, but also the fusion of statistical inference and also the computer computer science aspects of dealing with the federal large data set. So I see this as a very rich area, a very broad set of skills, which I'm sure you've witnessed this explosion in your career. So please comment on this aspect of your work.
We need more mathematicians in biology. I think maybe this is a good thing to elaborate afterwards, but I draw a kind of silly curve for students who come in with hard science backgrounds, and it's a decay curve, and I tell them that physics and math are at the top and social work is at the bottom, and molecular biology is just above social work. And I tell them, I don't care what you put on the axes, it's always true. It simply is very difficult for biologists to become quantitative. They're not intrinsically so. And that's why so many empirists... And while I've got the floor, I'll tell you one very quick story about the tragedy of the Genome Project. And the very beginning of the project, we invited, or others invited, mathematicians into the project. And when they arrived, they were asked, could you please build us a database? Could you please manage the data? And the mathematicians left in droves because they didn't see that it was really a problem for them yet. It was a trivial data management problem. And we're just now getting those individuals who are really thinking quantitatively about building models, about prediction, all the things that math can bring to this digital biology back into the field. Mostly it's dominated by people who are very good at data management. So please hone your quantitative skills, and the physicists and the mathematicians should come back and take over. I'm a biologist, so I could speak like this.
Stop here for just a moment and give you your first of two hands.
Thank you.
On behalf of the Institute for Advanced Study, we have a little memorabilia for you. Nice move there, John. Coordination is not my strong suit.
Probably my fault, actually.
Let me be careful with this.
Wow.
So we will take this out carefully, and if we have a photographer in the house, this might be a good time to bring forward, but if we don't, I'll just let you hold this up for all to admire. And
thank you very much. You're very generous, everybody.
Thank you, John. Now, we have a reception. It's outside on your right as you proceed southward from this point, or east, westward, whichever it is to your right, and you get out the door, and look for desserts and coffee and things to drink. And thank you all for coming out this evening.
You're very thoughtful, John. I'm really